and of CSF, lawyer Jean de Senarclan, last name spelled small d-e, capital S-E-N-A-R-C-L-E-N-S, was chairman of the Geneva affiliate of the Stanford Technology Corporation, a California-based company Hakim had founded before his partnership with Secord. Hakim has declined to comment on his possible involvement in the Iran or Contra operations. CSF's company director, or chief executive, Willard Zucker, Z-U-C-K-E-R, also has declined comment. Attorneys for both men say they have done nothing illegal.
Excuse me, Nip, why don't you start? Like a fool, I forgot to start the second tape recorder, so why don't you pick this article again up right here so we don't lose any material
All right.
in the archive.
Very good. For those of you, again, not quite aware of what's going on, these a lot of these tapes are heard by people out of the area, and it's the only way they get to hear this, so bear with us here. We're going to go back over this section. According to published accounts of Honduran telephone records, the firm's Virginia telephone number was called from a, quote, safe house used by American pilots ferrying supplies to the Contras. Hakim also has business links to a Swiss firm, Compagnie des Services Fiduciaires, which reportedly was used to funnel profits from the Iranian arms sales to the Contras. The chairman of CSF, lawyer Jean de Senarclan, spelled small d-e, capital S-E-N-A-R-C-L-E-N-S, was chairman of the Geneva affiliate of the Stanford Technology Corporation, a California-based company Hakim had founded before his partnership with Secord. Hakim has declined to comment on his possible involvement in the Iran or Contra operations. CSF's company director, or chief executive, Willard Zucker, Z-U-C-K-E-R, also has declined comment. Attorneys for both men say they have done nothing illegal. Hakim is described by former business associates as possessing a shrewd financial mind and the ability to move money quickly throughout the world, especially in the Middle East, where he has extensive business experience and excellent contacts. He maintains an expensive home in the hills above Los Gatos. Companies Hakim has founded or owned at one time or another include Multicorp International, an Iranian trading firm that once represented Hewlett-Packard Company in Iran, Stanford Technology Corporation, STC, founded in Delaware in 1974 and reincorporated in California in 1981, International Imaging Systems, and a chain of delicatessens in San Jose, and the more recent Stanford Technology Trading Group. One of his firms developed a telephone monitoring system and mobile monitoring vans for the Shah of Iran. Another designed computer processing systems for interpreting satellite photographs, and others have made or proposed security systems for various governments in the Middle East and Asia.
Now, one of the most of that article is actually by way of reviewing a couple of the other articles that we've read. One of the interesting things is the name Willard Zucker. We're going to come back to Willard Zucker in the fourth part of our Iran-Contra series and here on Radio Free America, the part dealing with the cover-up. Just a small connection here, a small detail concerning Willard Zucker's background. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, December 2nd of 1986, a Times story by John Taliabue, T-A-G-L-I-A-B-U-E, headline, Dateline Zurich, headline, Swiss company calls dealings legal. Skipping down into the article, an interesting detail concerning Mr. Zucker's background. According to Geneva Business Sources, Mr. Zucker is an American lawyer and longtime resident of Switzerland. It is unclear whether he joined the company at its founding or shortly thereafter. Before joining the company, Mr. Zucker is believed to have worked for Bernard Kornfeld, the American financier who built Investors Overseas Services Limited, a mutual fund, into a multi-billion dollar operation before being forced out in 1970 by Robert Vesco amid charges of mismanagement and fraud that later brought Mr. Kornfeld a jail sentence. So that the fact that Willard Zucker was affiliated with Investors Overseas Services and Bernie Kornfeld is very interesting indeed, again, bearing in mind the Vesco connections to, among others, Santo Trafficante and some of the Orlando Bosch organization. It'll be interesting to see if the Vesco connection ever emerges in the hearings. I doubt it will. We're going to talk about it in the cover-up section.
A little earlier in the broadcast, we referred to a gentleman by the name of Glenn Robinette, R-O-B-I-N-E-T-T-E. We're going to read a short article in which some of his involvement in the Iran-Contragate affair is detailed. This is from the San Francisco Examiner for Monday, April 6, 1987. Oh, and before I start, I should mention broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. The article, again, from the Monday, April 6th Examiner of this year, is headlined, Rogue CIA Man's Links to... Oh, Contra Aid?
Hang on one second. We're a little bit out of order here before we get to Glenn Robinette.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, I know what you're saying.
Yep. Sometimes these things happen here. Forgive the bumps, but it's a lot of work here. We're all a little bit tired, and sometimes these things happen. Another, Peter Ma's article talked about four key players in the Iran-Contra scandal as being members of the Turple Wilson team. In fact, many more than four players are Turple Wilson associates, members of the Turple Wilson team. Another key name, and one we're going to come back to later in the broadcast, is that of Rafael Chichi Quintero. Information about him and his connections to Edwin Wilson from the San Francisco Examiner of Sunday, December 7th of 1986. This is a story by Newt Royce and Miguel Acoca of the Examiner Washington Bureau, headlined, Ex-CIA Agent Employed in Arms Drops at Stateline, Washington. A former CIA sabotage expert who until recently helped coordinate weapons drops for Contras inside Nicaragua was paid $4,000 a month by a network that included former CIA official Thomas Kleins and retired Air Force Major General Richard V. Secord, informed sources said. The sabotage expert, Rafael Quintero, Q-U-I-N-T-E-R-O, was an on-the-scene supervisor as weapons arrived in Central America, and he made repeated trips to Costa Rica, El Salvador, and Guatemala to inspect incoming arms and to coordinate their drop inside Nicaragua, the sources said. Working out of his Coral Gables, Florida firm of Orca Supply Company, Quintero supervised arms activities for the guerrillas after 1984 during the period that Congress banned all direct or indirect U.S. government military aid to the rebels trying to topple Nicaragua's leftist government. Several sources, including two with first-hand knowledge of the operation, confirmed that Quintero, a stocky, soft-spoken sabotage and weapons expert known to his friends as Chichi, received a $4,000 a month fee from a network that supervised the operation. Many of the arms shipments, the sources said, were paid by Saudi Arabian interests. The Examiner reported last week that Secord and his business associate, Albert Hakim of Los Gatos, had arranged Saudi-financed arms shipments to the rebel in an arrangement that preceded the Contra weapons deal linked to U.S. arms sales to Iran. Skipping down on the story, among the principals of the network, the sources said, were Kleins, to whom Quintero once reported when both were in the CIA, Secord, who has also been linked to the U.S. arms shipment to Iran this year, and Hakim, an arms dealer who Secord met in Iran in the mid-1970s. The sources said Quintero left the Secord Hakim Kleins network several months ago. He was replaced by Robert C. Dutton, a retired Air Force colonel who worked for Secord when Secord oversaw U.S. military sales in Iran in the 1970s, they said. Secord, Kleins, Hakim, and Quintero all were intelligence or business associates of Edwin Wilson, a former CIA contract employee who was serving a 52-year sentence for illegally shipping explosives to Libya in the 1970s and for the attempted murder of prosecutors and witnesses in the case, including Quintero. So again, Rafael Quintero, a key member of the Turple Wilson team, key member of the Contra supply effort, a name we're going to come back to.
Another key member, the one we began and then realized we hadn't talked about, Chichi, is a man again by the name of Glenn Robinette, another one who serves the dual purpose of, or not so dual purpose, of being a member of the Wilson Turple gang and also at the same time being up to his elbows in the Iran-Contragate scandal. Again, the article is from the Monday, April 6th, 1987 San Francisco Examiner. The headline, Rogue CIA Man's Links to Contra Aid. Subhead, Colonel North enlisted former associates of imprisoned arms dealer Ed Wilson. The article, again, is also by Miguel Acoca of the Examiner Washington Bureau. We're just going to read a short segment on, again, Glenn Robinette. A former CIA expert on technical devices, a friend and business partner of Kleins, and a former associate of Wilson in the CIA and in business. Robinette is being investigated over his association with Secord and Kleins and over a $2,000 security lock he installed on the gate of North's Virginia home after Secord told him North was being threatened by Middle Eastern terrorists. Robinette said he was seeking a lawyer. Attorneys for Secord, Kleins, and Hakim would not comment for this article. Quintero's attorney could not be reached. So Glenn Robinette, also a member of the Turple Wilson team and a player in the Iran-Contragate scandal.
Now, we're going to continue to focus on the Turple Wilson team. However, we're going to focus on an element of it and a person connected to Turple or Edwin Wilson, namely a man named Robert Keith Gray, who heads up Gray & Company, one of the most powerful public relations firms in the country. Interestingly enough, Gray & Company employed Robert W. Owen, one of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, May 15th of 1987. This is a story headlined, North's foot soldier tells of cash pipeline to Contras, subheaded Reagan aid quits after testimony. It's from the Chronicle Wire Services, Dateline, Washington. Robert W. Owen, a self-described foot soldier in the administration's secret war in Nicaragua, testified yesterday that at the direction of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, he delivered envelopes stuffed with cash, advice on arms purchases, and U.S. intelligence maps and photographs to Contra leaders. And moving inside the paper to the rest of this article, skipping down somewhat. In June of 1985, Owen was sent by North to a meeting at the home of retired Army Major General John Singlaub in Tabernash, Colorado, to discuss a $5 million shipment of arms that Singlaub was about to make to the Contras. Also said to be in attendance were Soldier of Fortune publisher Robert K. Brown and several of his associates. From there, Owen traveled, carrying a list on a legal pad of the weapons that Singlaub intended to buy, to San Francisco, From there, Owen traveled carrying a list on a yellow legal pad of the weapons that Singlaub intended to buy to San Francisco, where Calero was delivering a speech at the Commonwealth Club. He and Calero, that's Adolfo Calero, a key Contra leader, he and Calero then conferred with North by telephone about the list. Owen was employed by a prominent Washington public relations firm, Gray & Company, when he first met North and got drawn into the Contra supply network. When Gray & Company declined to do work for the Contras, Owen went to Central America to assess the needs of the Contras as their funds were running low in mid-1984. Although Gray & Company itself may not have worked directly for the Contras, as we're going to see, Gray & Company is inextricable from the Turple Wilson team.
Reading now from a book called Libyan Sandstorm by John K. Cooley, published in hardcover by Holt Reinhardt and Winston of New York, and copyright 1982. I'm going to read a little bit more about Robert Keith Gray and his connection to the Wilson team. After the Bay of Pigs, Cooley writes, Edwin Wilson helped establish a new Washington firm called Consultants International, Inc., CI, a front for CIA and U.S. naval intelligence activities. It was during this period, according to federal investigators, that Wilson and his associates were able to earn benefits well in excess of their salaries from commissions and kickbacks for exporting U.S. security and intelligence technology. One of Wilson's fellow board members on Consultants International was the leading Republican public relations man Robert Keith Gray, who was co-chairman of Ronald Reagan's inaugural committee. Gray denied ever knowing that Wilson was on the CI board, but said he found Wilson, quote, charming and very much a red-blooded American, unquote. Well, if we ignore the rather ingenuous assertion on Mr. Gray's part that he didn't know that Wilson was on the board, again, the connection here, not only that with Gray himself, but the direct connection into the Reagan White House, Robert Keith Gray being on the inaugural commission and being, as they mentioned, the leading Republican public relations man.
Now, the Gray & Company, the public relations firm, also has some very interesting links to the whole Libyan situation and Muammar Gaddafi, obviously, so do Turple and Wilson. Research credit for the following story goes to a listener. This is from the Salt Lake Tribune of Sunday, September 28, 1986. It's about a man named Neil Livingston, or Livingstone, and it's headlined, Livingstone is the name, counterterrorism is his game. Skipping down on the story, Welcome to his world. Neil Livingstone is the name, counterterrorism the game. It is a world of studied mystique, scoffed at by some as a smoke and mirrors province of the right wing or a fast bulk consultancy scam exploiting scared travelers, valued by others as a reassuring guide service through the global minefield of alien cultures and political violence. At 39, Livingston is one of the more flamboyant and controversial of the breed. Anti-terrorism is the fastest growing industry in America, he says, which is why it has attracted every type of bozo and thug along with some very good firms, unquote. Although he regards himself as one of the more rational voices in the trade, others, particularly academicians, view Livingstone as an alarmist ideologue who advocates assassination and the violent overthrow of governments, and scares up clients with high decibel prophecies of germ warfare terrorism. Skipping down again, Livingstone has lots of former lives, former Hill aide, former partner in Air Panama Airlines, former power broker at public relations firm Gray & Company, former executive in a now-defunct security company, and a pretty lucrative present. Skipping down still further in the article, enter Bob Gray, who, quote, wanted to create an international division, unquote, of Gray & Company. Enter Bob Gray, who, quote, wanted to create an international division, unquote, of Gray & Company. Livingstone's credentials? My special expertise, if you will, unquote. His work for Gray began, quote, when Bob Gray needed advice about Libya, unquote. Livingstone had once been arrested there, he says. Someone put a machine gun in my ribs, unquote. He was taken to, quote, a secret police headquarters that a friend of mine in Libya did not know existed. I had to go through a very lengthy interrogation, and at the end had to sign a confession in Arabic. It could have said, for all I know, that I am a CIA agent. It was pure expletive, but I figured I was in a tight spot. Afterward, there were profuse apologies, and they let me go. I never figured out whether it was mistaken identity or what. Last year, Livingstone, who supervised Gray's foreign operations, was placed on leave after the company reached a severance agreement with its then-vice chairman, Alejandro Orfia. This followed an investigation of Gray's Madrid office, which raised concern that Orfia had been involved in money being transferred from a client to a Spanish legislator for the purpose of influencing legislation. Livingstone's name never surfaced in any of the alleged dealings, except as supervisor of foreign operations. So again, the connection of Gray & Company to the Iran-Contra operation through Robert Owen, the connection of Gray & Company to Edwin Wilson through Consultants International, the connection of Gray & Company to the Reagan administration, Gray helped arrange Reagan's inaugural proceedings, and the connection of Gray & Company to Libya through Neil Livingstone and the international division of Gray & Company are worth keeping in mind here. We're going to come back to Robert Owen later in the broadcast.
Another interesting gentleman who, as far as I know at this point, we're still not positive that this connection exists, but it's something to speculate about anyway. His surprise appearance is detailed in the San Francisco Examiner for Friday, June 5th, 1987, in their Iran-Contra hearings section. And it goes like this. A surprise witness, lawyer David Lewis of Washington, spelled L-E-W-I-S, by the way, testified earlier Thursday that a Hakim associate had approached him to find a way to funnel $70,000 to Betsy North. That's Oliver North's wife. The associate, Willard Zucker, who we discussed earlier, suggested setting up a phony real estate commission to transmit the money. Then skipping down and looking in the witness file, as they call it, for the New York Times, Friday, June 5th, 1987, talking about the same David M. Lewis, they give some personal and pertinent facts as follows. Age 40, position partner in the Washington law firm of Finkelstein, Thompson, Levinson, and Lewis, practicing primarily securities law. Role, Mr. Lewis was approached by Willard I. Zucker, an American lawyer who in effect ran one of the Swiss companies involved in the secret transfer of funds from the Iranian arms sales to the Nicaraguan rebels, to help design a fund for Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. North's wife, Betsy. Mr. Lewis testified that the amount in the account was to be approximately $70,000, but that nothing came of the conversation. He called the committee and volunteered his testimony. Now, the question with David Lewis is he just a lawyer that Willard Zucker called out of the clear blue sky and asked to arrange a shady transaction for no reason, or as David Lewis in some other way showed up earlier in this series of interwoven connections?
Now, we're going to be, again, we don't know if this is the same David Lewis, so this is a speculative link here. We're, in essence, asking the question, are these David Lewis's one and the same? A book about Edwin Wilson, not in and of itself that good a book, called The Death Merchant, by Joseph C. Goulden, G-O-U-L-D-E-N, is worth contemplating in this regard. There's a lot of good information in the book, but it discounts Wilson as an active intelligence agent, and that's frankly ludicrous. Again, this is The Death Merchant, subtitled The Rise and Fall of Edwin P. Wilson, by Joseph C. Goulden, G-O-U-L-D-E-N, and Alexander W. Raffio, R-A-F-F-I-O, published in softcover by Bantam Books, copyrighted 1985. About Edwin Wilson's defense on one of a series of trials he had, Goulden and Raffio write as follows. Once again, Wilson was represented by new defense lawyers. For reasons he would not discuss, Harold Price Farringer had resigned himself to handling the appeals on the Houston conviction and the active defense evolved to a three-man team of Michael G. Dowd, D-O-W-D, David Lewis, and William Mogulescu, M-O-G-U-L-E-S-C-U. Scrappers all, the new lawyers had attracted attention earlier in 1983 by winning acquittal for persons accused of smuggling guns to the Irish Republican Army. Dowd, the legal counsel, said only, quote, "We got a phone call and Ed Wilson was suddenly our client 6 weeks before trial." Phew. So again, the same David Lewis? Is this yet another Triple Wilson connection to this whole operation? That is the question that has to be answered.
Okay, now we're going to go on and talk about another one of the most interesting players in this whole thing, and a man who we have again been talking about for a great length of time. His connection to the various forces involved in the Wilson-Turple team are long-standing. He was a key participant in, although an unwitting participant, nevertheless a key participant in our five-part series on the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II. He is a man who has gotten a great deal of attention during the Reagan years, a man by the name of Michael Ledeen. We're going to talk about him and talk about some of his connections to this whole affair right now. The article is from the Washington Times for Tuesday, December 16, 1986. Research credit goes to Mae Brussel for providing us with this article. And it goes as follows, at least the section that we're going to read. They're talking now about the initial attempt made to make contact through Manoukher Gurbanifar between the Reagan administration and the Iranian government as far as ways to get the hostages released. Details of the offer were passed along to the administration by Theodore G. Shackley, a former CIA official and a friend of Mr. Ledeen, the newspaper said. In a 1980 article in New York Magazine, Mr. Ledeen called Mr. Shackley, quote, "one of the CIA's most esteemed officers," unquote, excuse me, who was driven out, quote, unquote, of the agency by former President Jimmy Carter's CIA director Stansfield Turner. Mr. Shackley also has been a consultant for Stanford Technology, Inc., the Northern Virginia firm that employs retired General Richard V. Secord and Iranian-born businessman Albert Hakim, wrote Peter Moss in Manhunt, his book about convicted CIA agent Edwin Wilson. General Secord and Mr. Hakim are under investigation in the Iran-Contra affair, Justice Department officials say. Mr. Moss also wrote that in February 1982, Mr. Ledeen, then at the State Department, approached a federal prosecutor saying, quote, he, meaning Michael Ledeen, had heard disquieting rumors about an investigation of Shackley and former Pentagon official Eric Von Marbot, unquote. The FBI was investigating them in a case involving alleged overcharges from a shipping concern, but no charges were ever brought against the two. Mr. Ledeen writes frequently for major publications about terrorism, Italy, Western Europe, and Central America, his areas of expertise, according to a biography distributed by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Skipping down in the article, one of Mr. Ledeen's most controversial articles, written with Arno de Borgrov, now editor-in-chief of the Washington Times, appeared in the New Republic just before Jimmy Carter's defeat in 1980. And, of course, that article that Michael Ledeen wrote with Arno de Borgrov was, in fact, the Billy Gates scandal article that helped, among other things, along with the failed rescue attempt on the Iranian hostages held at that time, the U.S. Embassy hostages, helped to scotch the Jimmy Carter presidency.
Now, Michael Ledeen, as Niptuck pointed out, figured very prominently in the five-part series we did on the shooting of the Pope. Michael Ledeen, to make a very long story very short, is Mr. Terrorism. He's the one who blamed, one of the ones who blamed the shooting of the Pope on the Bulgarian Secret Service, whereas it now appears quite apparent that the crime was committed by Western intelligences, our own in particular, and he is, in general, sounded the terrorist drum long, loud, and hard. We are regaled frequently with Ledeen tirades about the dangers of international terrorism and the Gaddafis, the Khomeinis, and so forth. It's interesting to see him in bed with arms sales to one of the terrorist masters, namely Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran. This, of course, it should not come as too much of a surprise in light of what we've been looking at over the years with the Triple Wilson team. But again, bear in mind Michael Ledeen, his many interesting connections to the shooting of Pope John Paul II, Alexander Haig, Luigi Sficciolo, and others. And we're going to read you a little bit more about his association with Messrs. Shackley and Von Marbod. Reading now from the book we alluded to earlier, in fact, we read an article written by the author. This book is called Manhunt, subtitled The Incredible Pursuit of a CIA Agent Turned Terrorist. It's by Peter Maas, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1986, of the Ladine Shackley von Marbod Secord Association. The author, Peter Maas, writes as follows. At the time when the FBI was investigating Shackley, Kleins, von Marbod, and Secord, auditors from the U.S. Maritime Administration had uncovered massive abuses in EATSCO bills to the Pentagon. General Secord, the only one still in government service, was removed from his key position in the sale of arms to the Middle East pending a polygraph. But he never took the test. Instead, without any prior notification to the Justice Department, he was abruptly reinstated by Frank C. Carlucci, a former deputy director of the CIA who had become the number two man in the Defense Department. Then one night near the end of February 1982, Barcella got a curious visitation at home from Michael Ledeen, the State Department's expert on terrorism. Barcella knew Ledeen. He had bought the first house that Larry and Mary owned. As a writer on political and intelligence affairs before his State Department job, Ledeen had published a New York Magazine article savaging Admiral Stansfield Turner for forcing Theodore Shackley out of the agency. And now, in Barcella's den, Ledeen was saying that he had heard disquieting rumors about an investigation of Shackley and von Marbod, especially von Marbod. He was a man of impeccable honor, practically his idol, said Ledeen. He had saved countless lives and equipment after the fall of Saigon and of the Shah in Iran. Ledeen couldn't explain why von Marbod had suddenly quit the Pentagon, because he had always been such a fighter, unquote, but Larry could be barking up the wrong tree. Any billing abuses that were being questioned might have gone for a covert operation. An interesting statement here by Michael Ledeen in light of the subsequent covert operation billing abuses, which did indeed go to a covert operation. So again, Michael Ledeen, obviously an associate of many players of the Turple Wilson team, and also, at least from appearances, one of their main PR people, because many of the crimes committed by people associated with this team have been pounced on by Michael Ledeen as, you know, crimes of the evil empire, etc., etc.
Now, one of the interesting things about this case, again, as with so many of these things, originally, when we began talking about these people several years ago, as we mentioned earlier, the ties are so incestuous, and the circles are so small, and the same people keep showing up in so many places that the allegation of conspiracy theory was being thrown at us and at Mae Brussel and other people who have looked into this stuff, and we're not the only ones. Anyway, the epithet conspiracy theorist was tossed around a great deal. Well, of course, one of the things is that when people are in fact working together covertly to subvert the laws of the land, to carry on a secret foreign policy, to murder, to smuggle drugs, and to smuggle weapons, and all of this being done at the same time while being covered up by members of the United States government and actively supported by members of the United States government, it's real difficult to find a word that is not conspiracy. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this case, as I mentioned just a moment ago, is the fact that everything dovetails and that things are so tightly knit together in these groups. One of the things that spawned one of the things that led to a lot of the information in this case coming out, and in fact some of it coming out apparently with the help of Edwin Wilson, and we've been talking about at great length, is the Christic Institute suit we talked about earlier in the broadcast. The Christic Institute suit was initiated because of the fact that Tony Avergan and Martha Honey were present at Eden Pastora's press conference at La Penca when a bombing was carried out. So again, it's rather interesting to find out that indeed the same people seem to be involved time after time in these affairs. We're going to read a little bit from the Daniel Sheehan affidavit, which is part of the Christic Institute suit, and we read from it earlier in the broadcast, and we're going to look a little bit into this self-same secret team, as they're calling it, and we have called it, Wilson, Shackley, Kleins, Secord et al., and also into the La Penca bombing and just how that came to be.
It should be noted here, too, now, with regard to the Lapenka bombing, we're going to come back to this, that it was blamed initially by U.S. press on the Sandinistas.
As these things so often are, as the Orlando Letelier assassination we looked at earlier in the broadcast, with the help of George Bush's CIA, was blamed first on the Castro and the Cubans and on the Chilean anti-military left and so on and so forth. It's a very common practice. Anyway, reading from the Sheehan affidavit, supplying the Contras. Source number 49 has direct knowledge that it was this, quote, secret team of Defendant Shackley, Kleins, Secord, and Hakim, operating through their business partnership with Edwin Wilson, named the Egyptian-American Transport and Service Company, otherwise known as EATSCO, I will put in parenthetically, incorporated January 79, who first established contact with and began secretly supplying weapons, ammunition, and C4 explosives to the Contras soon after they began operations in Honduras in August of 1979, and who later, under a separate corporate cover, supplied C4 explosives and military equipment to the Contras through John Hull in Costa Rica in 1983 and 84. The, quote, field officer for this secret team was Defendant Rafael Chichi Quintero, the man who met with the field commanders of the Contras in Honduras and the Contra associates of John Hull in Costa Rica to take their orders for weapons and explosives, and who saw to it that said military supplies were delivered. Defendant Quintero conducted his activities on behalf of this secret team through a Florida-based corporation named Orca Supply Company, a company earlier set up by Edwin Wilson. This information was obtained by plaintiff's counsel from source number 49 and from persons who have spoken directly with persons directly involved in this operation. Under the supervision of Defendant Theodore Shackley, Defendants Thomas Klein, Secord Hakim, and Rafael Quintero have been directly responsible for the private supplying of military equipment, including the C4 explosives supplied to John Hull in 1983 and 84, which were used in the terrorist bombing attack at Lapenka on May 30, 1984. Indeed, a close associate of Defendant Quintero trained persons in Honduras to make deadly C4 anti-personnel terrorist bombs identical to the one used at Lapenka. These defendants were responsible for the entire supply of weapons, ammunition, and explosives to the Contras in Honduras and Costa Rica from August of 79 up to October of 1986, with the exception of the time period between June of 81 and March of 84, during which time American CIA Director William Casey and his agent Vincent M. Canestrero supplied such materials. Let's go back and touch on a couple things real quickly here. The field officer for the secret team, Defendant Rafael Chichi Quintero, himself an Ed Wilson associate, set up the secret team transmission of weapons through a Florida corporation, Orca Supply Company, also an Ed Wilson corporation. In fact, Shackley, Klein, Secord, Hakim, Quintero et al. Have been responsible and tied to, in the Sheehan affidavit, this is the very C4 explosives supplied to John Hull, which were then turned around and used in the Lapenka bombing. So we've got the explosives themselves coming directly through the Ed Wilson spawned secret team. We have other connections in the bombing also through the Wilson team.
Now, a little bit about the bombing. One of the main reason for the bombing was that Aden Pastora refused to be aligned with the CIA and the other Contra elements, whose military commanders basically were former Samacistas. Because of this, he became a pain in the CIA's side, and in particular, the secret team decided that he had to go. Reading now from an article in These Times, the issue of December 10th through 16th of 1986. Pastora refused to go along with the merger. He said the FDN would have to be purged of its Somocista commanders, remnants of the years of dictator Anastasio Somoza, before he would agree to such a plan. Pastora, the infamous Comandante Zero, battled to oust Somoza before turning against the new Nicaraguan government. On the 29th of May, 1984, a bomb exploded at Pastora's press conference in Lapenka, Nicaragua. The Contra leader was injured, and 8 others were killed. Evidence strongly suggests that network members were responsible for the bombing, and some of them would later allegedly conspire against TAMS. That's Louis TAMS, former U.S. ambassador to Costa Rica. We're going to talk about that later. Members of the network linked to the Pastora plot reportedly met in Miami in January of 1985 to assess the problems with the Lapenka bombing, and decided they would move against the recalcitrant Contra leader a second time. Jack Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-L-L, a former mercenary who fought with the Contras in Honduras, says he attended that meeting. He has since turned against the Contras and is assisting in an ongoing congressional investigation of the arms network. See story on page 12. In an interview, Terrell named those in attendance. They included the network's heavyweights, Robert Owen, FDN leader Adolfo Calero, Tom Posey, John Hull, and Cuban-American Felipe Vidal, as well as several others. Amak Galil, G-A-L-I-L, a Libyan citizen and explosives expert who, Terrell later learned, had planted the bomb, was waiting outside the door during the meeting, according to Terrell. "We put a bomb under him, Pastora, but it didn't work because of bad timing," Terrell quoted Felipe Vidal as saying. Terrell's notes from the meeting indicate that Terrell was to organize the next assassination attempt. The termination of Zero discussed, Adolfo Calero very upset with statements made by Pastora. Says he too son Anicia. Must die. Big problem. Asks me to put it together and not to tell him how it will be done. Seems Rob Owen is in on most of this. Must appear that Sandinistas did it. So Amak Galil, a Libyan, is the explosives expert who actually planted the Lapenca bomb. And again, the U.S. press did indeed portray the bombing at first as the work of the Sandinistas. Now, we're going to return to the Sheehan affidavit here. You're going to hear a couple of names at the beginning of the section Niptuck is going to read. These names are those of informants for the Christic Institute and the Honey Avergan suit, and they were many of them also former participants in the Contra supply effort.
All right, reading from the Sheehan affidavit and going on to detail some of the dirty dealings in the Contra underground. Cruz and Sainz had informed David, that the preliminary decision to assassinate Aiden Pastora had been made by John Hull, Felipe Vidal, René Corbo, and Adolfo Calero in a series of meetings in or around January of 1984, when it became clear to these men that Pastora was neither going to allow non-indigenous Nicaraguans, such as the Cuban-Americans, to participate in his Costa Rican-based Arde military effort against the Nicaraguan government, nor was Pastora going to allow his Costa Rican-based Arde forces to be melded into a unified Contra command under the leadership of Adolfo Calero's Honduran-based FDN Contra force. David reported that this January 1984 preliminary decision to kill Pastora had been made in meetings held on John Hull's ranch among Hull, Vidal, and Corbo, and later between these men and Adolfo Calero in Honduras. David reported that this preliminary decision was finalized in a meeting in Miami, Florida, in February of 1984, between Vidal and Corbo and their, quote, sponsor, Francisco Paco Chanes. It was Cruz and Sainz who informed David as to the steps taken from the point of that final February 1984 decision in Miami to the actual bombing at La Penca on May 30, 1984. Other sources set forth below have verified specific steps in this chain of events. They are as follows. In February of 1984, Felipe Vidal and René Corbo flew from San Jose, Costa Rica to Miami, Florida, where they met personally with Francisco Paco Chanes. Chanes was the de facto owner of two Miami-based seafood and import companies. These were Ocean Hunter, Inc. and Mr. Shrimp. These two private companies were in fact the vehicles through which Francisco Paco Chanes smuggled into the United States up to one full ton of Colombian cocaine each week from Jorge Ochoa and Pablo Escobar via John Hull's Costa Rican ranch. Paco Chanes was also an ardent financial supporter of the ultra-right-wing Miami-based Cuban anti-communist organization Brigade 2506. Silent partners in Chanes's two, quote, seafood import companies were Frank Castro and Rolando Martinez, fellow intense anti-communists. In this February 1984 meeting in Miami, held between Paco Chanes and Vidal and Corbo, Chanes gave his final approval to the participation of Vidal and Chanes in the assassination of Aiden Pastora. Vidal and Corbo then sought advice from Chanes as to whom they might retain to carry out this assassination. Paco Chanes sent Vidal and Corbo to meet with Frank Castro and Rolando Martinez. Vidal and Corbeau met with Frank Castro and Rolando Martinez in Miami in February of 84 and were in turn sent to see one Niles Hines, H-E-I-N-Z. Hines, in turn, sent Vidal and Corbeau to meet with one Ramon Cecilio Palacio, a man reported to be the, quote, chief of security in Miami for Jorge Ochoa. In February of 84, Vidal and Corbeau met in Miami with Ramon Cecilio Palacio, who placed them in the hands of two Cuban brothers, introduced to them as Ricardo and William, in quotes, Gris, which is Spanish, by the way, for gray. These two men are believed by plaintiff's counsel's sources to be, in fact, one Raul Villaverde and one of his two brothers, either Rafael, and in parentheses, if he was not really killed in a yacht explosion in Miami, or Jorge, a cocaine smuggler associated with Palacio and Ochoa. The, quote, Gris brothers brought Vidal and Corbeau to Chile and introduced them to Amak Galil, a notorious international right-wing terrorist who was, at the time, working for the dreaded secret military police of Chilean dictator Pinochet. Galil was paid $50,000 by Vidal and Corbeau to plan and execute the assassination of Aiden Pastora. Between March and May of 1984, Amak Galil traveled through Panama up into Costa Rica, where he went to John Hall's ranch. On John Hall's ranch, Galil obtained from John Hall 3 kilograms of C4 explosive, portions of which had been smuggled onto John Hall's ranch through the combined efforts of defendants Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, Rafael Chichi Quintero, John Hull, Bruce Jones, Thomas Posey, Ronald Martin, James McCoy, and Mario Delamico. So, again, the fascinating chronology of the whole thing, but again, the step through the Miami underworld of the the groups linked to the anti-Castro groups, but the contra groups and the Ed Wilson network, again, where Amak Galil came from, where the explosives themselves came through, and through John Hall, himself connected to General John Singlob and the World Anti-Communist League.
So again, in that passage, we find the following names all linked. The aforementioned Francisco Paco Chanez, Frank Castro, the member of Orlando Bosch's Carew group, we read about earlier in the program from Assassination in Embassy Row, Rafael Chichi Quintero of the Triple Wilson team, Amak Galil, perhaps Rafael Villaverde or one of the other Villaverde brothers, the La Penca bombing, which was the project that they were all collaborating on, and interestingly enough, Jorge Ochoa, the key member of the Medellin cartel, which, recall, at the beginning of our series, was supposedly trafficking drugs with the Sandinistas. In fact, they were working with the Contras, and this is what was bankrolling them to a considerable extent.